Today is Tuesday, September 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Irma leaves mass devastation to the U.S. state of Florida and beyond. Millions are without power.
Emergency services personnel, they're trying to clear debris. They're trying to get roads cleared.
Marking 16 years since the deadliest terror attack on American soil, the U.N. imposes even tougher sanctions on North Korea. Also ahead, a horror film involving creepy clowns is breaking records in U.S. theaters. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, residents of the Florida Keys may be unable to go home for weeks. The Keys were the first part of Florida slammed by powerful Hurricane Irma on Sunday morning. Irma's winds and strong storm surges swept over the island chain, wrecked roads and bridges, and swept homes and cars aside. What was left after the storm passed is not fit for reentry for regular citizenry for weeks, according to White House Homeland Security Advisor Thomas Bossert.
The Keys are going to take a while. We have not assessed the structural integrity of the bridges there. There's some early reason to believe that some of the drawbridges that were up may or may not have been bent. And so restoring those is going to take some time. That Route 1 is a large, expansive bridge, essentially. All of the undergirding there has to be examined for structural integrity. I would expect that the Keys are not fit for reentry for regular citizenry for weeks. If that's wrong and I'm wrong, then fine, then let the local officials bring you in. But I would set that expectation pretty broad right now. And I would say that for the people that chose to stay, they had every warning to leave. We hope that they took that warning. And those that didn't, we're going to get back down there as soon as we humanly can. And right now, we don't know. We had three or four overflights today. I talked to the FEMA administrator just before coming out here, and he is not certain yet that we've had a good overflight assessment of where all those people might be. Neither of us would be surprised if lives were lost, but neither of us would be surprised if the responders are going to get down there aggressively. So we're doing everything we can to help them.
One main highway travels from the mainland to Key West, a famous tourist destination. That's the southernmost part of the U.S. Bossert says many of the scores of bridges that carry the road from the island were badly damaged. Meanwhile, the Navy sent three ships to help with rescue and recovery efforts. Florida Governor Rick Scott is warning residents things won't get fixed overnight.
I know for our entire state, but especially for the Keys, it's going to be a long road. There's a lot of damage. I know everybody wants to get back to normal. I know everybody wants to get started, but again, you gotta be patient. You gotta get the first responders in the Keys. We gotta get the water going again. We gotta get electricity going again. We gotta get the sewers going again. It's gonna take a lot of time.
More than 6.5 million homes and businesses are still without power in Florida. And joining me for an update on how the shelters are faring is National Red Cross spokesperson Nigel Holderby. So, where are you located today?
So I'm actually in Orlando at the headquarters office where the operation has been managing the different evacuation centers and shelters for this entire response.
How many people are still in shelters or evacuation centers throughout the state?
So overnight, there was an estimated 132,000 people that were in shelters and evacuation centers that are, you know, government and Red Cross partnerships where we are working in partnership with our community partners to have these spaces available. Now, there were over 510 of these different spaces. So think about that for the size of the state of Florida. When you look at the American Red Cross Emergency app, the number of little Red Cross dots on there, and that's really a combination of these evacuation centers that are in partnership with the state. Just in Florida, an estimated 127,000 people in those areas, there are still people there, but there are people who are now able to go home. I think a really important message to talk to the community, to people in the community about right now is really you have to heed the warnings and the advice of the community leaders. So your emergency management, the police and the fire, the emergency services personnel, they're trying to clear debris. They're trying to get roads cleared. And so really heed those timelines. A lot of spaces were still in kind of that lockdown mode for if there's water or storm surges that are still happening. So we want to make sure that people don't just rush out. You know, it's nice and sunny out here. So the storm is over, but there's still dangers out there.
Right. I would imagine they're, like you said, there are probably still power lines down. I know that millions are still without power. So if they're flooded.
Water and electricity is dangerous. And so we want to make sure that people are being very cautious and not going back into areas to check on their homes until the officials are giving the all clear for that.
Yeah. And what happens when someone does get the all clear and their home is destroyed and they have nowhere to go? Then what?
So that's when we are going to look at what the needs are in that community. And then you may see the very possibility that Red Cross will open a more permanent sheltering operation. So we talked about previously the difference between an evacuation center and a shelter. Evacuation centers are really that emergency space that is life-saving, may not have cots for everyone to sleep on. We're going to get as many people comfortably and sometimes uncomfortably into a space where they are not going to be in harm's way from a hurricane. So they're going to be safe. But then when we look at when people go back to their homes, now what does that look like? We're doing the damage assessment and really looking at which families are going to need more assistance and meeting with those folks and helping them individually to recover from this. That's a different level, and that's when Red Cross and partner agencies in the community step into the recovery phase of an operation.
Have you been able to observe or hear from any of your colleagues what the situation is on the ground in parts of the state? Are some places just devastated?
So there are still many places where people have not been able to go out of the evacuation centers yet. You know, there are still places where people have not been able to see what that looks like. Many people will be without power, and so that means we may bring food into an area and do some feeding in our emergency response vehicles. So we don't know what that part of this response looks like at this point. We're still getting that information, and it is kind of a slow process, we know, but we want to make sure that people have the things that they need to move forward and that we do that with each individual as they need it.
National Red Cross spokesperson Nigel Holderby, and if you'd like to donate or help, text 90999. Memorials were held Monday to remember the victims of the terror attacks of September 11th, 2001, including a somber ritual that included the tolling of bells. And the reading of names of the close to 3,000 people who lost their lives.
Joanne Marie Adiolis.
Shabir Ahmed.
Terrence Andre Aiken.
Godwin O.
Two giant towers of light have also lit up the lower Manhattan skyline as a visual memorial, beaming up that reaches 4 miles into the sky. President Trump said terrorists have nowhere to hide Monday as he led the nation in observing the 16th anniversary of the worst act of terrorism on U.S. soil.
The terrorists who attacked us thought they could incite fear and weaken our spirit. But America cannot be intimidated, and those who try will soon join the long list of vanquished enemies who dared to test our mettle.
The president and first lady joined Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and members of his cabinet at the Pentagon to observe the anniversary of the attacks. Vice President Mike Pence traveled to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where a fourth jet heading for Washington crashed into a field after passengers overpowered hijackers. He paid tribute to the passengers who overcame those hijackers and prevented what could have been another horrific chapter in the story.
In the days ahead, like every American, we would learn the story of the 40 heroes of Flight 93, men and women who looked evil squarely in the eye. And without regard to their personal safety, they rushed forward to save lives. They were mothers and fathers, your brothers and sisters.
Earlier, President Trump led a moment of silence on the White House lawn at 8:46 a.m., the exact moment the first jet smashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. 16 years later, that moment reawakens horrific memories in millions of Americans. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Pope Francis asks pro-life Trump to rethink the young immigrant decision. Former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon is saying that Trump's biggest mistake was firing FBI chief James Comey. Top Russian diplomat is urging U.S. to stop destroying Russia-U.S. relations. And scientists say DNA tests show a Viking warrior was a female. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The UN Security Council unanimously agreed Monday to step up sanctions against North Korea over the country's sixth and most powerful nuclear test on September 3rd, imposing a ban on the country's textile exports and capping imports of crude oil. Koro Besho, Japan's ambassador to the UN, said the choice for peace is in the hands of Pyongyang.
A peaceful diplomatic solution, which we all want, is in the hands of North Korean regime. If North Korea wants peace and security, it needs to demonstrate concrete measures for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, comply fully with the relevant Security Council resolutions and joint statement of the six-party talks, and thus come back to the dialogue table.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley said the U.S. just wants peace.
We don't take pleasure in further strengthening sanctions today. We are not looking for war. The North Korean regime has not yet passed the point of no return. If it agrees to stop its nuclear program, it can reclaim its future. If it proves it can live in peace, the world will live in peace with it. On the other hand, if North Korea continues its dangerous path, we will continue with further pressure. The choice is theirs. Thank you.
It was a ninth sanctions resolution unanimously adopted by the 15-member council since 2006 over North Korea's ballistic missile and nuclear programs. The U.S. watered down an initial tougher draft resolution to win the support of Pyongyang ally China and Russia. The UN human rights chief has joined the growing chorus of international voices condemning Myanmar for the wave of violence that has forced scores of minority Rohingya Muslims to flee across the border to Bangladesh. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayed Rahad Al Hussein painted a dark picture of growing violations and abuse in an address to delegates.
We have received multiple reports and satellite imagery of security forces and local militia burning Rohingya villages and consistent accounts of extrajudicial killings, including shooting fleeing civilians.
Al-Zayed also called out the government of Aung San Suu Kyi for doing nothing to stop the slaughter.
The Myanmar government should stop pretending that the Rohingyas are setting fire to their own homes and laying waste to their own villages. This complete denial of reality is doing great damage to the international standing of a government which until recently benefited from immense goodwill. I call on the government to end its current cruel military operation with accountability for all violations that have occurred and to reverse the pattern of severe and widespread discrimination against the Rohingya population.
The UN estimates nearly 300,000 Rohingya have left fled the neighboring Bangladesh, adding to the hundreds of thousands already there living in refugee camps. VOA's Ira Melman talks more about these atrocities with Andrea Gittleman with the Center for the Prevention of Genocide, which is part of the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, asking how they became involved in this effort to stop what's happening.
Well, we at the museum Center for the Prevention of Genocide are very concerned about mass atrocities around the world. Burma or Myanmar is one of those countries that has come to our attention because of the long-standing risk to the Rohingya population. In 2015, staff from the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide traveled to Rakhine State in western Burma, and we were alarmed by what we saw.
What did you find?
Well, we visited in 2015, and there we saw the effects of long-standing persecution against a community that had been cut off from their neighbors. Rohingya Muslims who were forced into displacement camps just because of who they were. We saw people who were unable to access health care, access education, again, simply because of their religion and ethnicity.
A few years ago, the Holocaust Museum awarded Aung San Suu Kyi, now the leader of Myanmar, with the Elie Wiesel Award. Now, Aung San Suu Kyi has been almost unbelievably silent about this entire situation. Why do you think that is, and how can that be rectified, if it can?
Well, Aung San Suu Kyi, as the de facto leader of her country, needs to speak out against military attacks on civilians. She and her party have the ultimate responsibility to protect all civilians in the country. The Holocaust Museum awarded her the Elie Wiesel Award because she upheld those values of confronting hatred, of preventing genocide, and therefore we would call on her to embody those values today and to speak out forcefully against attacks on civilians in her country.
Andrea Gittleman is the program manager at the Center for the Prevention of Genocide, part of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington.
And you're listening to VOA News. This is International Edition.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday issued a temporary order allowing the Trump administration to maintain its restrictive policy on refugees while the court considers challenges to the travel ban. Justice Anthony Kennedy issued the order, which is temporary and expected to remain in effect while the full court takes up the matter, likely within a matter of days. Joining me to discuss is San Francisco appellate lawyer Anna Rose Mathiesen. Thanks so much for being with us. Can you explain exactly how big of a win this is for the Trump administration?
The ruling on Monday was a very minor win for the government. The big argument is going to happen October 10th when the Supreme Court decides whether or not the travel ban itself is okay. All that happened on Monday was an order from the Supreme Court saying for one more day until today, Tuesday, the government's current ban can keep going. So it was basically a 24-hour continuation. And it's a minor win because the government didn't even challenge one of the things they were initially fighting about. So they initially argued that they should be able to exclude grandparents of people from the United States. So the Supreme Court, back in June, when it issued its order on this, said you can't enforce the travel ban for anyone with a, quote, credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. And the Supreme Court didn't really say what that means. So for the last couple months, courts have been fighting over what does that mean to have a credible claim of a bona fide relationship. And the government said, well, it doesn't mean grandparents or a number of other groups of people say, wait a second, I'm really close to my grandparents. Supreme Court justices are certainly close to some of their grandchildren. Why shouldn't it include those? So the government tried to exclude a number of those family groups, but the district court in Hawaii and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, nope, sorry, you have to, at least until the Supreme Court rules in after it hears argument in October, you have to let those groups in. So the government gave up on that. They didn't try to challenge at the Supreme Court whether or not those groups in. All they argued in this current, in the order that was issued on Monday, was that refugees should be allowed to be excluded until the Supreme Court decides whether or not the ban is constitutional. So just refugees with a relationship with the U.S. resettlement agency.
Is it likely with the newest justice that was appointed by President Trump, Justice Neil Gorsuch, that it leans even more likely to be, it will likely lean even more in favor of the Trump administration?
Well, Justice Gorsuch has definitely, throughout these proceedings, has indicated his agreement with the ban. So that the court hasn't formally ruled on the merits, but Justice Gorsuch has always voted that he would have stayed the district court order in its entirety. That is, he would have said everything until the Supreme Court decides, everything the government wants to do, it should be allowed to do until the Supreme Court. And that is is pretty much a signal that he doesn't think the ban is a problem. But whether it's any more likely, right, he replaced Justice Scalia, who quite likely would have voted with Justice Thomas and Justice Alito, two other justices who also said they would have stayed the district court order in the entirety. So I'm not sure that the addition of Justice Gorsuch instead of Justice Scalia shifted it that much. It's really been, you know, the focus of this has been on Justice Kennedy throughout these proceedings. I think that's quite likely where things are going to come down to, as it so often is.
San Francisco attorney Anna Rose Mathiesen with the Appellate Law Group in San Francisco. The forthcoming ruling by the nine judges of the Supreme Court could decide the fate of up to 24,000 refugees. Turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, of course, Hurricane Irma, now Tropical Storm Irma, is trending. We actually saw the hashtag shift on Monday from hashtag Hurricane Irma to hashtag Tropical Storm Irma as the storm weakened. But just as it was with Hurricane Harvey in Texas, people are using social media to reach out for rescue when the phone lines are down, when they can't get through to first responders. But there's a new effort from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, their Urban Risk Lab, where actually they're trying to use social media to get some good data and to try to help people going forward in these instances where there's flooding and natural disasters. So they're doing a thing called the Risk Map. It's a platform to track flooding, and they're testing it out in southern Florida, testing it out over the weekend with Hurricane Irma. And what it does, basically, it allows people to report where there's flooding, the water depth, the conditions, via their social media platforms. That information then gets gathered onto this map, and people can actually use that to see where there's flooding, where maybe they need to direct resources to try to help people or save people. The idea is that this could eventually allow for flood conditions to be reported in real time on social media and create a more cohesive effort for emergency preparedness. Remains to be seen how this test will work out, but they're very optimistic that this could be a big step forward in using social media to try to help people.
Unless there's no power.
Well, unless there's no power. But that's actually where social media comes in. When there's no power, you can't use your phone if it's an electric phone.
Right.
You can post to social media if your phone still has battery. So this is the hope. And that's what we saw a lot of with these other hurricanes, that people couldn't use the phones, so they had to go on Twitter or Facebook and put out these messages to first responders. So hopefully this risk map will allow them to track that flooding and better help people in the future.
Cool. Anything else happening we should talk about?
There always is.
That's true.
And there's always a lot to talk about with social media trends. Who is using social media? What are people using it for? Of course, with this risk map, they're using it to do some good. Here's a story about who is actually using social media. Pew Research did a new survey, and they found that about two-thirds of Americans are getting their news on social media. Scratch that. Let me start over. Pew Research did a report, and they found that although social media tends to be dominated by young people, or so we think, actually two-thirds of American adults are getting their news on social media. And even more than that, for the first time ever, a majority of adults over the age of 50 are getting their news on social media. So we talk about, you know, all the trends and young people and millennials with their phones. Well, it's not just them. Everybody's using social media to get news. And perhaps unsurprisingly, Facebook is the number one social medium in the U.S., as it is around the world, really. Over 2 billion users around the world. It shows that social media really cuts across all cultural barriers. It's not just young people. It's people of every age group. And this really shows that we're democratizing information. Anybody has access to information, no matter what age you are, who you are, where you are. It's all available right there on your smartphone.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA underscore IE.
Hello. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The people of South Sudan are experiencing the world's worst food security crisis, one caused not by drought or flood, but by man-made conflict, a power struggle between President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar that spiraled into a civil war in late 2013. Famine was declared in part of South Sudan in early 2017, but with quick action on the part of the international community, including the United States, famine was alleviated 4 months later. However, the overall food security situation in South Sudan remains dire, with more than half the current population, 6 million people, facing life-threatening hunger this year. The United States is the biggest donor to the massive humanitarian effort in South Sudan. Since 2013, we have contributed nearly $2.7 billion in humanitarian assistance for the South Sudanese people, including those who have fled to neighboring countries. $729 million has been provided in 2017 alone. In South Sudan, one of the biggest obstacles to delivering emergency aid is gaining access to those in need in one of the most difficult and expensive countries in which to deliver assistance. South Sudan is also the most dangerous country in the world for aid workers. Since the conflict began in December 2013, 85 aid workers have been killed. According to the United Nations, nearly 630 incidents hindering humanitarian access occurred between January and July of this year. Some 36% of them involved violence against humanitarian personnel, assets, or civilian infrastructure. So far this year, 27 security incidents have forced around 300 relief workers to relocate from areas of operation. At the same time, humanitarian aid organizations have complained that their movements are often restricted, often by the government. During a visit to South Sudan on September 2nd, USAID Administrator Mark Green said, "While it is true that we support the people of South Sudan, it is just as true that the situation has deteriorated to the point where a serious reexamination of U.S. policy is appropriate. We urge President Kiir and his government to both acknowledge and address the worsening humanitarian crisis in South Sudan, restore a permanent ceasefire by ceasing ongoing military offensives, end obstruction of humanitarian access, eliminate exorbitant fees levied on aid organizations, and engage in a meaningful, inclusive peace process."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.